100 people crowded Eugene's Ferry Street Bridge area Saturday afternoon. They were split between supporters of President Trump and his critics. KLCC's Brian Bull was there.
There were profane taunts and chants of either four more years or Donald Trump go away. But the event was mostly peaceful. Sam Owen of Dexter says he backs Trump on the economy and Second Amendment. He appreciated the turnout, as well as some people's attempts to debate rationally on the sidelines.
A lot of people having a good time supporting our president. Some having a good time not supporting our president. Whether you're Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, we're all Americans. Now we're all in this together.
One anti-Trump activist, Nicholas Jensen, questioned the rally's timing. Just before the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday.
I am very upset that these Trump rallies seem to be coming on days like the Women's March, and the last one happened to be on Eugene Pride. Perhaps they're trying to stifle our voices.
The event also precedes President Trump's impeachment trial in the Senate Tuesday. Name-calling and taunts flew angrily between both sides at times. Enter Margot Jennings and her group, Rise, Dance, and Resist. Upon shaking to the rhythms of Aretha Franklin's Respect, the dancers got people smiling and moving along to the music themselves.
It was about to be a volcano, but music dance is what will bring us together.
Maybe not on Election Day.
No, well, on Election Day, we'll take care of business for sure.
Trump supporter Amy Howell of Almsville danced too.
This is a little liberal, more than what I'm usually into, but I just think it's beautiful. Both sides are mingling and having a good time, and I can't think of a better way to stand up for freedom in America.
There were still shouting matches, but largely the tension seemed diffused. Brian Bull.
In 2017, Eugene joined the first National Women's March in defiant protest of President Trump's inauguration. It attracted 7,000 marchers. This year, around 40 people showed up on Saturday. It was unclear whether a march would happen this time, since organizers hadn't acquired a permit and the event wasn't well publicized. But Michelle Nosala says she was determined to show up and added that fatigue may have been a factor.
We've gone through 3 years of failures and setbacks and letdowns and disappointments, and it just hasn't gone well, and I think people are tired, but that's no reason to stop, because it can get worse. And that's really a big concern for me.
Despite a much lower turnout, the overall theme remained the same, with anti-Trump chants and calls for change as the nation heads into another presidential election year. Other marches took place in Corvallis, Roseburg, and Redmond. Mallory Begay, KLCC.
After a standoff that lasted nearly 12 hours, Eugene law enforcement shot an armed man as he left a relative's townhouse in the South Hills last night. All through the afternoon, well into last night, police tried talking him into surrendering. A negotiator with a bullhorn asked the man to leave the residence on the 100 block of Westbrook Way towards an EPD robot with a phone.
You can talk to the robot, you can talk to the phone. Best case scenario, you can calmly walk to the front door and come on out. Hands up, hands empty.
Later as night fell, a loud blast interrupted the negotiator, possibly a police stun grenade or flashbang. The man reportedly fired several shots at police. Then before midnight, he left the townhouse with his rifle. Shots were fired and the suspect was given emergency medical aid by personnel before being taken to a hospital. Lane County's interagency deadly force investigation team is now investigating the incident.
Across the country, racial and ethnic disparities have led to minorities being more likely to contract coronavirus. As KLCC's Elizabeth Gabriel reports, Lane County is no exception, with Latinx community members disproportionately affected by COVID-19.
Latinx community members make up 21% of COVID-19 cases, according to Lane County Public Health, even though they're only 9% of the county's total population. But David Saez with Centro Latino Americano says these disparities aren't new, but a magnification of health and economic disparities.
Community members that come from the Latinx population and immigrant families tend to come from economically marginalized kind of position, socially and And they also are disproportionately impacted by health issues.
Saya says they are working with Lane County Public Health and the Oregon Health Authority to provide COVID-19 information in Spanish. Elizabeth Gabriel, KLCC.
Federal officials in Oregon are denouncing hate crimes and discrimination sparked by xenophobia. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, much has followed the spread of COVID-19 in the U.S.
In a release, officials with the FBI and U.S. Attorney's Office say they'll prosecute racially charged crimes against Asian Americans and other minorities to the fullest extent of the law. They urge Oregonians to reject terms like the Chinese virus or Wuhan virus, which the president himself has used at times.
Calling a virus as if it belongs to any single country when clearly we're experiencing a global pandemic is just irresponsible.
That's Eugene resident Caitlin Howe. She says an Asian friend was harassed and spat on recently by a couple who blamed him for the pandemic.
In a situation like that, there's not much you can do because you don't want to escalate it. So he made the choice to keep on walking and talk to friends about it.
Amy Hertzfeld-Koppel is with the Western State Center, a progressive nonprofit. She says much of this rhetoric is being pushed by many white nationalist and right-wing extremist groups.
In a time of great fear and uncertainty, the risk to vulnerable communities and the threat to democratic governance really intensifies.
Hertzfeld-Koppel and Howe say it's important to challenge racist actions or language as it emerges, especially when unity is more important than ever.
We're also seeing efforts domestically and internationally to link Jewish communities to COVID-19 through baseless conspiracy theories.
The U.S. Attorney's Office has a COVID-19 civil rights coordinator as of March. They will investigate alleged civil rights violations within Oregon. Brian Bull.
It remains unknown which individuals created a bonfire in a traffic intersection and trashed a business complex in Eugene Friday night. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the riot grew out of a peaceful protest over the death of George Floyd.
Four businesses were looted during a large, unruly gathering of 300 people Friday night. Eugene police arrested 14 over the weekend, but none tied to the destruction at Washington and 7th Avenue. Social media buzz suggests the rioters were anarchists, Antifa, or white nationalists, to name a few. EPD Chief Chris Skinner says they were definitely not with the Black Lives Matter organizers honoring George Floyd.
The instigators were largely white, young men and women. Unfortunately, people have a tendency to want to lump this into a Black Lives Matter movement responsible for some of this violence, and we're just not seeing that at all. Our communities of color have been loud and proud, and they've also been very respectful and lawful.
The EPD was criticized for not moving in sooner Friday night. Skinner says dispersing the crowds with tear gas was safer than sending in personnel to arrest rioters. Brian Bull.
For the sixth night in a row, at least 500 people gathered in Eugene to protest the killing of George Floyd. As KLCC's Elizabeth Gabriel reports, the protest was mostly peaceful.
Beginning at 6 p.m., protesters met at the Eugene Federal Courthouse. People of color shared their experiences with racism and police brutality, while others expressed their efforts to promote equality. From there, protesters marched through the city, going toward the University of Oregon, down Willamette Street, past Kesey Square, and stopping at the Lane County Jail. While some black protesters have appreciated the support of white community members, others don't agree. Several black protesters ended the night by asking white protesters to be more considerate of their chants, referring to people who shouted George Floyd's last words, "I can't breathe," while dancing at Kesey Square Tuesday night. Hearing those three words chanted over and over again can be traumatizing and made some black protesters question the sincerity of people's choice to march. Protesters discussed holding another march at the federal courthouse today at 6 p.m. Elizabeth Gabriel.
In their eighth night of marching Friday, Black Lives Matter protesters aimed to keep the momentum going. As KLCC's Mallory Begay reports, BLM organizers have their sights set on police reform, not abolition.
Meeting once again at the federal courthouse, protesters celebrated youth and honored what would have been Breonna Taylor's 27th birthday by dancing. Taylor, an EMT, was in her Louisville, Kentucky home when she was fatally shot by police on March 13th. More than 500 protesters eventually made their way to Matthew Knight Arena. While the protest remained peaceful, a difference in how policing should occur in Eugene left some in the group divided. Those who wanted to abolish police, about 100, formed their own march and headed to the Lane County Jail. Meanwhile, the Black Lives Matter protesters brainstormed ideas for police reform. So far, this includes the resignation of EPD Chief Chris Skinner and less police in schools. In an effort to spread the movement, BLM protesters are heading to Springfield on Saturday. Both Friday night protests ended before midnight. Mallory Begay.
A Eugene crisis intervention service may become a template for the justice reform called for by Black Lives Matter activists. KLCC's Brian Bull explains.
For more than 30 years, CAHOOTS has dispatched teams specialized in mental health counseling and medical training to people in distress, including many homeless. Their work has been praised for alleviating the burden of police, allowing them to focus on actual crimes. Now, after the death of an African-American man, George Floyd, at the hands of police in Minneapolis, that city's leaders say they'll dissolve the department and create a new public safety agency. And CAHOOTS is being cited as a model. CAHOOTS Operations Coordinator Tim Black.
There's an opportunity to really talk about how cities can provide compassionate response and really look at what types of situations actually need a uniformed armed officer to respond and what types of situations could be resolved by a different type of presence, you know, a different type of response.
CAHOOTS is a service of White Bird Clinic. It stands for Crisis Assistance Helping Out on the Streets. Brian Bull.
Two statues that symbolize Oregon's history and legacy of taking of indigenous land were torn down Saturday evening on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene. KLCC's Rachel McDonald reports this happened after a teach-in at D.D. Hall.
That's the sound of the pioneer statue being pulled down with ropes from the pedestal where he stood in a central location on campus since 1919. An unidentified group then proceeded to chip and drill at the statue's face, then using the ropes, dragged him across 13th Avenue and up the steps of Johnson Hall, the U of O's administration building. The group then marched to the Pioneer Mother statue and proceeded to pull her down. The statues have been the subject of protest as they symbolize the legacy of white settlers killing the indigenous people of the West and taking their land. Last year, student groups urged the university to remove the statues, saying their presence was a constant reminder of racism and hate. Rachel McDonald, KLCC News. Monday evening, community members gathered in downtown Springfield to support local police. As KLCC's Elizabeth Gabriel reports, counter-protesters were also in attendance.
Beginning at 5:30, roughly 300 pro- and anti-police protesters met at the Springfield Public Library. Tensions between protesters rose on multiple occasions, causing police officers to step in to de-escalate several fights. At least one anti-police protester was arrested.
No justice, no peace, no fashion, police.
Before the night ended, anti-police protesters stood in a line across from Springfield Police on several occasions, one of which included chants for Stacey Kinney, who was killed by SPD in March 2019. The protest concluded around 9:30. More protests in support of Black Lives Matter and defunding the police are being planned for later this week in Eugene. Elizabeth Gabriel, KLC.
This year has seen the Black Lives Matter movement gain greater national prominence through protests over police brutality and systemic racism. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, Native Americans have had their voices elevated as well, owing to a shared history of oppression, cultural stereotypes, and conflicts with the federal government.
For more than a century, the Pioneer statue stood on the University of Oregon campus. With bullwhip and rifle, many Oregonians saw him as representative of the settlers who traveled thousands of miles to tame the Old West. The Pioneer's journey took an unexpected turn in June, shortly after a teach-in by the Black Indigenous People of Color group. Unidentified protesters pulled the statue to the ground, then dragged it onto the front steps of the U of O's administration building. A companion statue, the Pioneer Mother, was also toppled that day.
My immediate response was, I wasn't surprised. I was just wondering why it took this long, really.
Jacob Billy is a recent graduate at the U of O. The Yakima Nation member says for years, many of his mentors and classmates implored administrators to remove the statues, or at least acknowledge the land's original inhabitants with something similar.
The Kalapuya were here and they were displaced. Say you're living in your house. Somebody comes up and says, I like your house and the stuff in it. Get out. That's basically what happened. So it's glorified by these tales of pioneering and, of course, that they had to suffer to come across to this land and settle it. Well, natives were already living here.
Besides the displacement of Native Americans, blacks were restricted by Oregon's provisional government from owning land. Those laws were only completely repealed in 1926. That legacy of oppression has led both groups to rise together in recent months. In late June, an event was held in Owen Rose Garden called Indigenous Solidarity with Black Liberation. It drew about 150 people. One speaker was Violet Johnson, a Hoopa Indian of Yurok descent.
This nation was built on stolen labor and stolen land, and through that we have what we know today as this capitalist country.
Participants discussed George Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police and missing and murdered indigenous women. They also spoke of slavery, lynchings, and boarding schools before circling a teepee. Nationally, black and native activists have supported each other by knocking down statues of Confederate figures or those associated with colonialism, like Christopher Columbus. This intrigues Therese Cheney, an associate professor of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies at the U of O.
The connections people are making between white supremacy and anti-blackness on the other hand and white settler colonialism on the other hand have been a breakthrough moment in American history. I think we're in this very exciting and scary moment, which is a moment of growth for the nation.
Cheney says in her 49 years, she's never seen such an outpouring of mutual support.
Indigenous communities have always been struggling, for example, against the use of mascots, against the destruction of sacred sites, but their numbers are so much smaller than other communities of color throughout the nation. I do think that the broadening awareness of racism and white supremacy in the U.S. has helped to buoy indigenous protesting.
The Holiday Farm fire in the Mackenzie River area has grown to 105,000 acres since sparking Monday night along Highway 126. About 200 crews are working the fire, but Damon Simmons, public information officer with the Holiday Farm fire, says there should be more like 1,000 people on this blaze.
The fire, it's really moving, and we don't have enough resources. We have asked for more resources. But as most people are aware, this fire situation encompasses the entire region and the entire state and the entire West Coast. So there aren't any resources for anybody else to send right now.
Simmons says fire crews are just trying to save lives and entire communities. They're hoping for a break in the weather. He urges people to pay attention to Lane County Sheriff evacuation updates. In Salem yesterday, many evacuees from the nearby Santiam fire made their way to the state fairgrounds. Marion County and the Red Cross have set up an evacuation center there, and they're trying to connect displaced residents with supplies and shelter. One of those evacuees spoke with KLCC's Dirk Vanderhart.
3 years ago, Dennis Malam and his wife traded in a retirement life in their RV for a dream house. They found a plot of land in the town of Gates, east of Salem, and they built their home right on the Santiam River. On Monday night, the couple left that home for the last time.
The trees were coming down and I could see the glow of the fire, so we just evacuated on our own.
All the news they've heard since has been dire. Driven by gusting winds, the Santiam fire rushed down the canyon, enveloping town after town along Highway 22. Malam's been told there's not much left of Gates to return to.
It's all burned up.
I'm so sorry to hear.
Yeah, there's only a couple of houses that we know of that didn't get burned to the ground, so everything's burned pretty much.
The couple was able to find lodging in Salem. They came to the evacuation center at the fairgrounds to see what help officials might be able to offer, but left only with some bottles of water and a lot of uncertainty.
Thousands of people have lost homes and businesses in the wake of the Holiday Farm fire on the Mackenzie River. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert has this story of a working mom who built a successful company in Blue River, literally from the ground up, before it was taken down in flames.
Molly Morris is the president and CEO of McKinsey Mist Pure Artesian Water Company. She has offices in Eugene, but the source of her product and the facility where it's bottled is in Blue River. Morris has always been nervous of the wind. She says when the gusts picked up on Monday, she had a bad feeling. She was in town Monday evening when her phone started blowing up. Morris learned her family and McKinsey River property were in trouble. The wind was whipping up a fire on the river. Her oldest son, Colton, jumped to action.
Colton's house is in Blue River. It was right next to the clinic. He had just bought that house a year or two ago. He's been working diligently to fix it up. He's so proud of it. And so he was out protecting it and defending it.
Morris says her son got his information listening to a police scanner.
Nobody dreamed that a fire that had broken out 8 miles away would have traveled that far and be on our doorstep in 2 hours. They issued a code 3 alert. I said, Colton, when did they issue a code 2? And he goes, they didn't. It went right to get out now.
Molly and Gail Morris started McKinsey Mist over 25 years ago. The deep source well and bottling facility on their Blue River property, along with houses and a guest yurt. Morris says Colton and his pregnant fiance drove the half mile to the property with a growing Holiday Farm fire closing in behind them. He woke his father and brother, and with the clothes on their backs, they fled to Eugene.
All Tuesday, we waited and worried. There was no word. There was no way to get any word as to the fate of our piece of property, because you can't see it from the road. But my son said, Mom, prepare yourself. It's probably gone.
Then Colton heard about his house. It was completely destroyed. He asked a state patrolman to check his parents' property and the McKinsey Mist facility. They received word on Wednesday that there was nothing left. Part of her wants to see the aftermath and get that over with.
But on the other hand, I don't want to see it, because then it's real. Right now, it's almost theoretical. It's a story.
Evacuation levels are being downgraded for some areas around the Holiday Farm fire that's burned over 166,000 acres and destroyed more than 300 structures. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, evacuees are more than ready to come home.
Crews are slowly containing the fire, which drove hundreds of people out of Vida, Blue River, and other towns last week. Leanne Blodgett of the Upper Mohawk Valley and Shelby Todd of Marcola recall their escapes.
It came within a mile and a half of my home. So far, it's still standing.
And what were you able to leave with?
Everything that was worth anything, even my lawnmower.
My mom had recently had hip replacement surgery, and I'm her caregiver, so Tuesday afternoon, we left, and it was chaotic getting out even at level 2. There were cars backed up on Marcola Road for miles.
Both women are staying at the Graduate Hotel Eugene for free, thanks to the Red Cross. Many hotels are near capacity with evacuees who are anxious to get back and pick up the pieces. Forestry officials warn damage to the area poses short and long-term hazards. Brian Bull.
Christiana Rainbow Plews is making national headlines. She's the Upper McKenzie District Fire Chief who lost her home and fire station in the Holiday Farm fire. Plews is also one of fewer than 50 women in the nation to hold the title of fire chief. She's credited with saving countless lives when ordering Level 3 Go Now evacuations for most of the McKenzie River Valley when the fire ignited on Labor Day. KLCC's Tiffany Eckert has this profile.
World, meet Rainbow. That introduction begins one of thousands of social media posts piling on accolades for the rural fire chief on the McKenzie River. When she took the leadership post in October 2018, she says there was some administrative pushback about using her middle name.
That's career suicide. And I was like, yeah, but I am Rainbow. Everybody knows me as Rainbow. Like, that's my name that I go by. Then I was told that that was just completely unreasonable. So I was kind of like, yeah, whatever.
Chief Rainbow has been in the firefighting business for 30 years. She's had to navigate her career with very few women mentors. It was around 8:30 p.m. Labor Day when Chief Rainbow got a call on a small grass fire at the Holiday Farm RV park near Blue River. She put on her boots and wildland gear and hit the door. The first thing she noticed was the whipping wind.
I just had a really sinking gut feeling that this was going to be something much bigger than what we got tapped out for.
The Holiday Farm fire, which started as less than a tenth of an acre, soon grew uncontrollable when those historic high winds blew the burn across the highway and toward houses.
At the time, I was basing all of my efforts and my decision making on muscle memory.
Chief Rainbow called for a quick battalion, neighboring crews to help fight the growing blaze.
Shortly after that, I called for evacuations. We were just driving our trucks and running our sirens and knocking on doors personally. We got a lot of people out.
She says she remained on the fire for 56 hours before she collapsed. Looking back.
Mop-up operations on the Holiday Farm fire are incorporating roughly 1,000 firefighters from 18 states and Canada. As KLCC's Brian Bull explains, it's all part of a coordinated push to contain the fire as the weather stays cool and rainy.
About a dozen firefighters of the Oregon Air National Guard are dousing charred stumps in an area north of Vida. They also use tools called Pulaskis to dig up or break apart roots that can feed heat underground, eventually sparking new fires if left alone.
Swinging.
Captain Miles Dodge of Crew 7-2 oversees the operation.
We are mopping out a hot spot that's at the base of this burnt out trunk. The member down there right now is feeling for the significantly hot places with the back of his hands so he doesn't injure his hand. And then we have a bladder bag here with some water to cool it down if it gets too hot.
More and more residents are being allowed back home this week, though many are warned to be cautious of damaged trees that could fall and injure people. No one died when the Echo Mountain Complex fire swept through parts of Lincoln County last month, but the inferno destroyed hundreds of homes and touched countless lives. Now that the flames are out, locals are trying to figure out what comes next. KLCC's Chris Lehman reports.
You don't have to go far from David Gomberg's house to see the impact of the Echo Mountain fire.
We're just pulling out of the driveway. You can see the charred property right across the street.
Gomberg says his neighborhood that stretches along a rural road just north of Lincoln City was hit hard.
A third of the houses are gone. Completely gone.
Gomberg is a state lawmaker who represents the area in the Oregon House. He says he and his wife fled the advancing fire as the sun came up on the day after Labor Day.
Susie and I stopped right before we walked out the door, and I reached into the cabinet. I pulled out a bottle. I poured two glasses. And we toasted a million memories of the home that we had lived in for 30 years. And then we closed the door and left. And the flames were coming over the hillside behind us.
Gomberg says when you live on the coast, you're always thinking about potential disasters, just not this kind.
We think about earthquakes and tsunamis. That's what we prepare for. And this event caught us by surprise.
The cause of the Echo Mountain fire is still unknown, but it was driven by the same hot east wind that caused so much devastation in other parts of Oregon. While Lincoln County avoided any loss of life or serious injuries, officials say nearly 300 homes were destroyed, including dozens of mobile homes. And it's in a region that had a housing crunch to begin with, County Council Wayne Belmont told the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners.
There's no more significant challenge, I think, than the housing situation. It was already a challenge in Lincoln County.
It's a challenge that's on the radar of FEMA. The federal agency has been working with the Red Cross to find housing for people who lost their homes.
We try to keep people in their community. That's ideal.
FEMA spokesperson Jan Tracy says many evacuees are staying in hotels or with relatives. The agency is considering other options until homes can be rebuilt. But with rental property already in high demand, all options are on the table, including so-called FEMA trailers. Tracy says that's not as easy of a solution as it might seem.
It's not a fast remedy to an immediate problem because you have to have sewage lines, gas lines, electric lines. You can't just move a trailer, so to speak, in and dump it on the property.
Back in the fire zone, David Gomberg marvels at how much his neighborhood has been transformed.
total devastation up here. What's remarkable to me is the right-hand side of the street is gone, and the left-hand side of the street is not.
After 10 days of uncertainty,
we believed our house was gone.
Gomberg and his wife were allowed to return. He says a wave of relief swept over them.
But there's also a wave of guilt that comes in that says, my house is still standing and so many of my neighbors aren't. I mean, we came into the house. The two glasses were still sitting on the table. We had another toast to our good fortune, and then immediately went up the hill to see what we could do to help our neighbors that weren't nearly as fortunate.
The flames came within 100 feet of Gomberg's house and burned up trees and vegetation on about half his property. But he says his family's experience pales compared to the people in his community who lost everything. For KLCC News...
Oregon voters aren't being shy about turning in their ballots. KLCC's Chris Lehman reports.
By Thursday, nearly 1.7 million Oregonians had voted. That's roughly 58% of all registered voters. That's significantly more than the percentage who had voted by this time during the last two presidential elections. Katie Bolzendahl is the director of the School of Public Policy at Oregon State University. She says higher turnout means this election will feature more input from previously underrepresented groups.
So as that turnout goes up, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with the election result.
The deadline to return a ballot is 8 p.m. on Tuesday. It's too late to mail it in, so voters should use a ballot drop-off site. Chris Lehman.
As counting continues in the presidential race, several hundred people held a Rally for Democracy event outside the federal courthouse in Eugene today. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
In hope, in prayer, we find ourselves here.
Speakers led the crowd in songs and spoke of better days ahead should Joe Biden beat Donald Trump. Ellen Furstner of Marcola held a sign depicting a bloody coat hanger.
It represents when abortions were illegal. Now with the new Supreme Court judge, it looks like we're going to go back to those times.
Another attendee, 15-year-old Eitan Wax of Eugene, was there to show support for his LGBTQ classmates.
I am an ally. LGBTQ rights are very important to me, and climate change is very important because that is an immediate issue that we need to get on top of.
The Trump administration's actions on Planned Parenthood, climate change, and immigration have many progressives concerned over the possibility of four more years. Brian Bull, KLCC News.
In prayer, we're right.
After the presidential election was officially called for Joe Biden Saturday, KLCC's Aubrey Bulkley went to downtown Eugene to get people's thoughts.
Near the federal courthouse, Kim Pittman and Deb Lilly cheered as cars passed by. These two came from Fall Creek to celebrate Biden's victory. Pittman held a sign that said, United we stand, and Lilly carried the American flag. Both shared how they debated whether to put their Biden-Harris sign at the end of their driveway because of the Trump signs around them. Here's Lilly.
So we were pleasantly surprised that there was no gunshot holes in it, no vandalism, the sign stayed up.
Pittman added,
we realized if anything was going to happen, it was probably going to be people from out of the neighborhood. Because that's another thing about living in a rural area. When push comes to shove, we look out for each other.
Both said they wanted to be part of healing the division in America. Aubrey Bulkley, KLCC News in downtown.
COVID-19 cases are at record highs across the country, and no one knows that more than the doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers on the front lines. And many, like Tracy Arthur, have also become infected with the novel coronavirus. This story hits close to home for KLCC's Brian Bull, who's Arthur's brother. He talked to her about her ordeal with COVID-19, which led to her hospitalization recently in a Texas hospital.
When you were undergoing the worst of COVID, Tracy, were you conscious and aware of your surroundings the entire time?
I did a lot of sleeping, but looking back, that whole first week and a half was a blur.
Were there sometimes dreams or hallucinations or other surreal moments while you had COVID?
Worried about that part, you know, because since the pandemic started, you know, when I had gotten my first COVID patients, that was something that a lot of them had in common, that they would have these just really ghoulish nightmares. And a lot of times they couldn't even tell if they were asleep or awake while they were having these nightmares and hallucinations. You know, a lot of patients, I would just sit in their room with them, you know, because they were so frightened of these hallucinations and nightmares that they were having.
And you just had that.
I didn't really experience that.
Just a weird dream. Do you remember anything about the dream?
Yes. In my dream, me and my youngest son, we were driving along in the mountains in a pickup truck, and we saw Bigfoot. He was just kind of standing on the side of the road watching us drive by. It was weird.
At one point, Tracy, you said that you were very upset when the hospital in Texas wanted to discharge you. And do you recall why you were upset at the time?
Yes. So I had just gotten my fourth dose from Desivir. So the day shift charge nurse came in, and she told me that I was going to be discharged after my fourth dose. And I told her no. I said, the FDA recommends 5 doses. And she said, well, now they recommend 4. I've kept up on my treatments and the recommendations that the CDC puts forth. I feel that they were trying to discharge me because they needed that hospital bed. And I told her no, that I would not leave until I received my fifth dose, and I insisted on it. So then they send a doctor to talk to me. He did confirm that the FDA does recommend 5 doses, but it did get to a point where I had to call the patient care representative and voice my concerns, and I did get my fifth dose of remdesivir.
Now, having survived COVID-19, Tracy, has this experience changed your outlook on life at all?
Yes, it has. You know, I'm really anxious to get back home to my family. I really miss my kids and my grandchildren. It also really made me really grateful for the good nurses that I had, nurses that took care of me that were just outstanding nurses. When I go back to work, I need to maybe, you know, check on my patients a little more, make sure they're comfortable, you know, make sure they have stuff that they need. It just, you know, made me want to be a better nurse.
Well, Tracy, I'm so glad that you're alive and on the mend, and your whole family and I are proud of you, as is the Nez Perce tribe. Thanks to everything that you and frontline healthcare workers have done during this pandemic, and be well, keep doing great work, and I love you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, thank you. I love you too, Brian. Happy Thanksgiving.
KLCC's Brian Bull talking to his sister, Tracy Arthur, a traveling registered nurse who fought COVID-19 earlier this month. She's now recovered and is spending... Losing a loved one, especially a child, is devastating. Jennifer Phillips has felt that pain twice. Her 19-year-old daughter, Jessica Frank, was murdered by a man she met online 4 years ago, while her son, Chad Frank, died of COVID-19 last month at the age of 30. KLCC's Brian Bull met with Phillips, a registered nurse, and asked how she was holding up through the holiday season.
It's been very difficult without my family and my friends supporting me. I wouldn't be doing as well as I am. And I have a very good therapist I see weekly. And all those components are keeping me functioning.
You have other relatives for support, correct?
My child, Kaylee, and my grandchildren, Chad, had a daughter. And she has a brother. And so my grandchildren and my daughter keep me going.
What is it about Chad's life that you want people to remember?
Chad had a lot of obstacles in his life. He was born to teenage parents, had attention deficit hyperactivity disorder as a youngster. He was homeless and had some addiction issues when he was younger. He overcame that. He turned his life around in about the last 5 years and had stable housing, stable job. He got his driver's license back. He had his license suspended. He worked on getting that back. We were just so proud of him, how hard he worked and had overcome these obstacles and made these improvements in his life. And then just for him to just get sick and die the way he did was just so devastating. And I find myself at times not believing that he's gone. I'm still in the denial phase of grief and the shock phase.
Jennifer, when did you hear about Chad's death?
That morning, his father found his body. He went to check on him, I think around 9:15 in the morning. Nobody had heard from him. Chad lived alone. His father went to check on him, found him deceased. And I got a phone call that he was dead. And I was just absolutely hysterical. Because it, not only from losing Chad, but it brought back the trauma also of losing my daughter, Jessica.
And she was murdered by a man that she had met online. Have you been able to process and move on past that tragedy?
I haven't. No, I believe I've compartmentalized it. I've kind of put it in a special little box and put it away in order to be able to go on and function with my life.
From KLCC News in Eugene, I'm Love Cross. COVID-19 claimed 8 more lives in Oregon over the weekend, raising the state's death toll to 356. Oregon Health Authority reported 639 new confirmed and presumptive cases of COVID-19 since Friday, bringing the state total to 21,272. The new cases include 20 in Lane County, 23 in Deschutes, 10 in Linn County, 5 in Benton County, 3 in Douglas County, and 2 in Lincoln County. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says she's working on guidelines to require face coverings in office workplaces. Currently, face coverings are required statewide for indoor public businesses, but there are no specific guidelines for office settings. Brown says she's talking with medical professionals on what those guidelines would look like.
I think the challenge is that you have a diversity of office settings, and we want to make sure that people can remain safe regardless of the type of office settings.
Brown says she hopes to release those new guidelines in the next few weeks. In November, Eugene voters will decide whether or not to renew a 5-year levy for the Eugene Public Library. KLCC's Aubrey Bulkley reports.
The current levy, approved by voters in 2015, provides the library with $2.7 million every year. This funding is set to expire in June 2021. Since 2015, the library has increased programs, services, and operational hours. The new levy is meant to preserve current levels of operation. Executive Director of the Eugene Public Library Foundation, Reed DeVos McGowan, says if the levy doesn't pass, there will be difficult decisions.
As we live with the results of the pandemic, it's going to be really challenging for our community. And the library is a powerful free resource that can provide support in a lot of different ways.
If renewed, the levy would increase the average property taxpayer's annual costs from $36 to $37. This would provide the library with $2.85 million per year for the next 5 years. Aubrey Bulkley, KLCC News.
Some University of Oregon law students and alumni are still demanding change after a professor wore blackface to a Halloween party 4 years ago. KLCC's Elizabeth Gabriel reports.
In October 2016, U of O law professor Nancy Schertz wore blackface at a Halloween party at her home. Since then, the Black Law Students Association, or BLSA, created a list of demands to address the behavior. But they say none of them have been met. In April, the BLSA reiterated its demands to U of O administrators. This includes asking the law school to stop expanding Schertz's course load and provide student and faculty training on race in academic and legal environments. BLSA is asking people to sign their letter of support, which will be sent to the Oregon Law Administration. Elizabeth Gabriel, KLCC News.
With hot, dry weather continuing, fire danger ratings are at high for much of western Oregon. John Erickson with the Mackenzie River Ranger District in the Willamette National Forest urges people who visit public lands to be careful and always make sure your campfire is out. He suggests bringing a shovel and a bucket to hold water.
Even if you're just leaving your campsite for a few hours, just make sure it's out. If it's unattended, it needs to be out and cold. I think we can all recall those summers where thousands of acres have been burned, and I don't think any of us really want to see that or live with it.
Especially because the coronavirus pandemic means it's not business as usual for firefighters. Erickson says crews are kept in modules to limit contact with others. They're trying to keep crews safe and fire ready. Sunshine east of the Coast Range today, a mix of sun and clouds on the central coast. Expect highs around 90 degrees for Eugene, Springfield, Corvallis, and Bend today, mid-90s in Roseburg, and 65 to 70 for coastal communities. It will be breezy throughout the region today. Clear overnight tonight for most areas, while coastal communities will have cloudy skies, lows in the 50s for all areas, and sunny skies in the forecast for Tuesday and the rest of the week.